describe the 24-year-old star. Paul might have gone even further in his choice of adjectives. Agnes's curly, ash-blonde hair was perfectly done up in a halo around her face. Her skin was the same milky shade as her teeth. Her eyes were a winter gray, and they were impossible to read. Blue lace hung from the bottom of her green dress. The lace alone was likely more expensive than Paul's entire suit. And yet, as pristine as she appeared, her demeanor was not delicate. She was no porcelain doll. She was a distant glacier. Remote, quiet, and yet possessed of great and unknowable activity beneath the surface. Paul found the effect unnerving. Luckily, her mother, Fanny, did enough talking for the three of them. Yes, tea would be welcome. No, sugar would not. The matter that they had come to discuss was quite a delicate one. Paul's discretion would be appreciated. They were in need of an attorney who could see to it that the present situation did not find its way to the Sun's society page. Paul, Fanny Huntington had gathered, represented George Westinghouse against Thomas Edison. He had, perhaps, some experience with underdogs. He was unafraid of an unfair fight. The mention of Thomas Edison reminded Paul of his professional capacity. "I can assure you," he said, "that whoever it is who's giving you trouble, he could not possibly be as powerful a foe as Thomas Edison." This was precisely what Fanny Huntington wanted to hear. Paul did not get the impression that she was a woman frequently disappointed. She was among the smallest women Paul had ever seen, but fit a double-sized personality into a squat bullet of a frame. She was a rifle shell. Hardened and cooled, packed and loaded, ever ready to explode. How this mother had bred this daughter was a question for Mr. Darwin. The problem, Fanny explained, had begun in Boston, when Miss Agnes was singing with the Ideals. Was Paul aware of this group, she asked, and of Agnes's previous position therein? "Mr. Cravath is quite aware of who I am, Mother," said Agnes more sharply than he would have imagined. Her speaking voice had a hard edge. It gave no indication of the marvel that had made her famous. "He knows that I sang with the Ideals. He knows that I'm singing at the Met now. I'd wager he's likely been to a matinee." "I'm afraid I haven't been so lucky." Paul supposed this confession would lower him a peg in her estimation. "Well then, we must invite you to a performance," suggested Agnes graciously, without hint of condescension. Paul had met but two strains of celebrity. The first laboriously upheld the pretense of being unaware of their own fame. They feigned humble surprise when you knew who they were. Golly! The second were experienced enough in their position not to bother. Agnes, having fit more than a few years of fame into her brief life, was of this latter type. That she felt no need to prove anything to him while he felt such desire to prove much to her only accentuated the continent of social distance between them. "So, what is it that befell you in Boston?" he asked formally.
"Oh, it began in Boston," answered Fanny. "But the difficulty occurred in Peoria."
The Ideals, she explained, had traveled on their first tour of the Midwest. Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Missouri. Of course, Agnes had never before sung in such places, Fanny was quick to note. But W. H. Foster, the owner of the Ideals, had been motivated by pecuniary gain to attempt a tour of places that did not have exposure to the higher arts. Tickets had been discounted for farmers and the like. What the Ideals might lose in the quality of their patrons, they could make up for in quantity. Single-night engagements were the standard for the tour. An evening in Gary, Indiana, for example, before 2,000 theatergoers who were, as Fanny put it, inexperienced attendees of a fine performance. Then on to Dayton for another show the next night. Her daughter had begun to feel like she'd joined up with P.T. Barnum.
In Peoria, Illinois, this conflict came to a head. Mr. Foster told Agnes that to save money, she'd have to travel with the chorus. Naturally, such a thing wouldn't do. Agnes complained politely, but Mr. Foster had not met Agnes's arguments with reason. Instead, he'd met them with undeserved punishment. First, he forbade Fanny from traveling with her daughter. Then he began to skim from Agnes's salary. They had a contract, one that made very plain that Agnes was to receive $200 per week while on tour. First, $10 went missing from her weekly check. Mr. Foster said it was a mistake of his accountant's and he'd see to fixing it. He did not. A few weeks later, the deficit was $50, then $100, and soon enough, Agnes was receiving less than half of her agreed-upon salary. So, at the advice of her concerned mother, Agnes quit the ideals. She packed her bags, got on a train to Chicago, and 2 days later was home in Boston. Within a few months' time, the Met had happily moved Agnes and her mother to New York. Her career proceeded apace. However, their wish to put this whole miserable ordeal behind them had gone unfulfilled. Mr. Foster had threatened suit against Agnes for her sudden departure. She told him that he could keep the money that he'd stolen, but that wasn't enough for Mr. Foster. He was demanding that Agnes return to Boston to sing again with the Ideals. "And if Miss Huntington does not do as he asks?" asked Paul. "Mr. Foster claims to have many friends among the newspapermen of Chicago. He says that with only a letter, he could cause quite a stir. He could tell horrid lies to the paper about the reasons for Agnes's departure from the Midwest. He might even intimate..." "I cannot even say it." Paul waved his hand in the air, indicating that she need not continue. "A scandal, something of that nature." He looked to Agnes, attempting to gauge her response to this unpleasant tale. There was none. Agnes maintained an expression of utter implacability. Her eyes simply shone their February gray. Her lips betrayed neither frown nor smile.
"We need this to go away," said Fanny. "And we need it to go away quietly. Might you be able to assist us?"
What Paul was forced to say next was difficult. But it was unavoidable. "I would be happy to introduce you to my partners. They are excellent attorneys, and you'd be in extremely capable hands." There was a moment of silence from the women. Neither appeared particularly accustomed to being turned down. It was as if they did not quite know how to respond to such a thing.
"I'm afraid it's simply an issue of time," continued Paul. "I don't have any. George Westinghouse's defense requires my full and unfettered attention."
"It is some lawyer," said Fanny, "who is uninterested in a new client."
"Right now I have one client. I have one case. I must win it." Agnes seemed faintly amused by Paul's earnestness. If she was offended, she didn't show it. She looked rather like she had already forgotten about Paul's existence and was readying for her return to the great world of concerts and parties from which she had dropped in. Paul faced the unpleasant thought that she would go away so soon. When was the last time he had even spoken to a woman his age? But he knew what he had to do.
"Come along, darling," said Fanny. "There are 100 other attorneys on this block who would take your case with a moment's notice."
Paul's further apologies were dismissed. No sooner had they arrived than they were gone. Agnes leaving in her wake the faintest scent of some exotic perfume he would never smell again. He looked to the impossible stack of papers on his desk. "This is what is required of the victorious," he reminded himself. He remained at the office late that night, till his writing hand was useless, and he didn't sleep well.
Chapter 18 Fathers and Sons. A man, as a general rule, owes very little to what he is born with. A man is what he makes of himself. Alexander Graham Bell. Erastus Cravath was not impressed. Of this he made his son well aware over the course of his visit to New York at the end of August. Erastus was not impressed with Paul's client. Coal lamps were good enough for the family home in Nashville. He was not bowled over by Paul's 50th Street apartment. Erastus didn't much like New York in the first place. He couldn't imagine why Paul would want to live there. Erastus found the summer in Manhattan to be stifling. He found the city noisy, filthy, unpleasant. He found the conditions of the Jews, confined as they were to their Lower East Side tenements, to be appalling. He found the treatment of the Negroes in the Tenderloin to be even worse. Wasn't typhoid a concern? Erastus didn't know why his son's apartment still hadn't been properly decorated after 2 years of habitation. He was reticent to ask at which church Paul spent his Sundays, because he knew what the answer would be. He found Central Park overly manicured, like the fussy gardens of some ancient English lord. He hadn't a taste for lobster, but if Paul wanted to spend the money gorging on shellfish, he wasn't going to tell a 27-year-old how to feed himself. Paul had been informed by letter of his father's intention to visit. It would be his first trip to the city since Paul had lived there. He had business in the city. A meeting with some of the Fisk College donors, the few men in New York who possessed both strong moral convictions and the bank accounts necessary to support them. The old man had not even said that he was looking forward to seeing his son. Paul, in turn, wrote Erastus that while he'd be happy to host him, the case was keeping him exceedingly busy of late. He wouldn't have much time for entertaining. Erastus responded that he wasn't sure what New York had to offer in the way of entertainment, but he didn't think it would be much that he'd like, anyhow. When Erastus arrived, he lugged his baggage up the 4 flights to Paul's apartment, huffing up the stairs while refusing help along the way. He was almost as tall as Paul, but he carried considerably more weight around the middle. His white beard, Paul noted, had grown so long that the fraying tips touched his shirt front 3 buttons down. Paul had cleared his afternoon of work, but Erastus said the journey had been exhausting and he'd be grateful for a few hours on Paul's daybed. Paul did not have a daybed, he told his father, but the elder Cravath was welcome to Paul's own bed for both the afternoon and the duration of his stay. So Erastus took to the mattress at 2 o'clock while Paul puttered around the apartment idly. He pined for his office. When Erastus awoke, Paul offered to take him out for a decent meal. But Erastus pointed out that that was a waste of money. He'd be more than content to make a stew. Where was the local butcher so that he could get a good cut of flank steak? Paul made the stupid mistake of admitting that he didn't know. This allowed Erastus the invitation he required to comment that if only Paul had a wife, he might have some help with his shopping. The topic of Paul's ceaseless bachelorhood had thus been broached. Paul assured his father that he wanted a wife, that marriage wouldn't be far off, but that at the present moment work had been rather consuming. Wouldn't it be best to make a name for himself before he married? But you cannot, his father said as he boiled onions in the kitchen. Be after the love of a woman who loves you for your name. You want one who loves you for the man behind it. Paul's goal in this conversation was to see it ended as swiftly as possible. Receiving romantic advice from his father was like receiving financial advice from a junior Rockefeller. If one has never suffered for want of a thing, one has no conception of the trade-offs required in getting it. Paul's parents had a beautiful marriage. Of this he was convinced, although it confounded him. They'd met young and married instantly. His father could be irascible, his mother had a tendency to be even more judgmental than her husband, but together they were happy. And they excused each other's faults. Their rigid moralism stopped at the foot of their Tennessee two-story. They granted each other a forgiving kindness they granted few others. It was only as he'd grown older, as he'd seen his friends fall into their own uninhabitable and desolate unions, that he'd realized that his parents enjoyed a rare privilege. It was a privilege that Paul had not yet been afforded. In 27 years, Paul had kissed 4 girls. He never spoke of this, of course, but he thought about it sometimes, and the memories gave him pleasure to recall. Since his passing encounter with Agnes Huntington 2 weeks earlier, he found these memories both more insistent and more bygone. The first girl he'd kissed was Evelyn Atkinson back in Nashville. Her papa ran a shipping company down by the docks. Paul took his schooling at home, but every afternoon he'd run to the riverside to meet up with teenagers his own age. He had kissed Evelyn late one night as the wispy light from the cloud-shrouded Tennessee moon illuminated the dimples on her smiling cheeks. She was always smiling. That's what he remembered most about her. Even while they kissed, the corners of her mouth remained raised. By the time he'd kissed Gloria Robinson at the Autumn Tobacco Festival, his taste for kissing was undeniable. He told no one. Other boys teased him out of jealousy, but only for what they imagined he'd done, for what they imagined girls had let him do. Gloria's younger sister Emily he'd kissed 3 times, which he'd felt bad about, but as he was sure Gloria hadn't told Emily and Emily hadn't told Gloria and he'd told no one, there had been no harm committed. Still, it had probably not been his finest hour. He met Molly Thompson at Oberlin. She was quiet and red-headed, prone to fits of ticklishness in the Ohio grass. They'd kissed regularly. His classmates were certain that more than kissing had gone on. Rumors spread quickly in a school that small, but Paul and Molly knew the truth. They'd taken walks along Plum Creek, danced to the fiddlers in Allencroft Hall, and whispered the whole histories of their brief lives behind the sandstone houses along Lorraine Street. She'd asked him to return with her to her family in Cincinnati after they'd graduated. Paul had informed Molly that he was going to New York, and that was that. He'd received a letter from her once, while he'd been in law school. Her son was 6 months old and her husband was a senior clerk handling finances in the mayor's office. She wondered sometimes how Paul was doing. He'd responded by sending her a clipping from the Columbia Law Journal. His article had won the annual third-year prize. He told her he'd soon be graduating first in his class. She didn't write a second time. And that had been the extent of his wet-lipped career. Law school afforded little time for making the acquaintance of women, and his professional life even less. His bachelorhood had for some years been total. Paul knew that he was old, at 27, to be still unmarried. Not impossibly old, but older than most women of marrying age would like. He was a young attorney, but an old bachelor. Paul had made good choices in his life, and they were paying off. That he sometimes wondered what it would be like if he'd made other ones did not mean that he'd ever dream of taking any of them back. He could not quite say any of this to his father. Paul's gift with language did not extend to meaningful communication with the man who'd taught him to read. What would he gain by immodestly telling his father that he was, by most accounts, the most successful attorney of his generation, the lead litigator on the largest patent suit in the history of the United States. No matter what dragons Paul slayed, they would never be the kind to impress. Erastus was never going to change. He wasn't going to suddenly develop an interest in his son's views of the world. He wasn't going to start appreciating either Paul's ambitions or his accomplishments. Nothing would be gained by exposing to his father the fraying nerves of his heart. He was content to maintain cordial relations with the old man. The push for anything more would upset the fragile equilibrium they'd finally reached. Erastus saw no path to righteousness other than faith. He prayed to a Lord and Savior in whose existence Paul did not even believe. But to confess that to his father would be unthinkable. Whatever secrets he might imagine admitting, his university-bred atheism was not among them. And so they quadrilled genteelly through their conversation. Paul asked about his sister. She was well. He asked about his mother. She was also well. She'd suffered through the winter with a terrible cough, but the spring seemed to banish it, thank goodness. Erastus opined about the election. He was campaigning aggressively for Harrison, having seen firsthand what economic devastation Cleveland had wreaked. Paul wondered aloud whether Harrison would be able to convince the mugwumps to rejoin the Republicans in the fall. By 11, Erastus was ready, again, for bed. Paul lay on the floor of his sitting room, half wrapped in a blue cotton sheet. The apartment was hot in the summer, and Paul stayed up for some time, unable to sleep. Only after much tossing and turning was he treated to a series of dreams, one of which indelicately concerned a woman with the face of Agnes Huntington. Paul woke with a start at 5:30 in the morning to find that his father was already boiling coffee on the stove. Looking over the morning papers, Erastus grunted as his son got up and made his way to the sink for a shave. As soon as Paul sat, Erastus slid a page from the previous night's Evening Post in his direction. "Something in the paper there you might want to look at," said Erastus. "The editorial. It's on your line of work, isn't it?" By the time he'd gotten through the editorial's first sentence, Paul was apologizing to his father. His presence was required in Pittsburgh immediately. He needed to make haste to the Grand Central Station for the next train. Erastus said that he understood. He said that he could take care of himself just fine over the coming days. He'd leave the key for Paul at the coffee house on 54th Street. There were donors to be seen, the future of the college to be secured. Erastus had never seen the spires of Trinity Church, so he would be grateful for the chance to take a stroll. Paul was out the door, overnight valise in hand, by the time he realized that he'd forgotten to give his father a farewell embrace. He knocked at the closed door of his own apartment, the keys safely inside with Erastus. Yet Paul's father did not come to the door. Perhaps he'd gone back to sleep, or was unable to hear the knocking over the clatter of plates as he cleaned up the previous evening's meal. Paul turned away down the four flights, and off to Pittsburgh. Chapter 19. Death in the Wires. America is a country of inventors, and the greatest of inventors are the newspaper men. Alexander Graham Bell. Aboard a first-class car of the Pennsylvania Railroad, Paul reread the New York Evening Post editorial yet again. "Death in the Wires," blared the headline. "The Perils of Alternating Current." The article was attributed to Harold P. Brown, electrical engineer. Paul's first question concerned who in the world Harold P. Brown was. Paul's second concerned why he had been given such a prominent space to proclaim his absurd opinions. "Every day brings the news of more lives cut short by the menace of electrical wiring that now dangles above our city. Never in the history of this nation has such a dangerous, poorly understood, and criminally untested technology been thrust so haphazardly into the homes of our families and the playrooms of our children with no regard for their safety. The paper went on to mention the tragedy Paul had witnessed on Broadway, as well as other deaths at the hands of faulty electrical wiring. Several companies who have more regard for the almighty dollar than for the safety of the public have even adopted the new alternating current for incandescent light service, continued the paper. If arc current is potentially dangerous, then alternating current can be described by no adjective less forcible than damnable. That the public must submit to constant danger from sudden death in order that a corporation may pay a slightly larger dividend is simply evil. The paper went on to suggest, in language of unvarying vehemence, that alternating current was likely to fry the bones of any child within 100 feet of its use. Because it ran at twice the voltage of direct current, it was, so Harold P. Brown argued, twice as deadly. There was, moreover, no legitimate scientific reason to prefer alternating current to direct. Only the marketplace had caused these devious merchants of death to adopt this crooked technology. And finally, the paper named the main proponent of this deadly system: George Westinghouse. A villain who apparently will stoop to new lows to make an extra dollar off the naive and gullible. To prevent the wholesale loss of human life, concluded Harold Brown's editorial, all alternating current, such as that offered by George Westinghouse, must be banned immediately by the legislature of this state. That evening, Paul watched George Westinghouse pace across his laboratory. Gas lamps hung along the walls and washed the cavernous space with a pale orange light. Westinghouse's engineers feared that electric lights might interfere with their tests on new light bulb designs. The newest colors on the market, the softest yellows, the wispiest fading whites, the lightest bursting sun flares, were developed here. The colors of the future had to be examined in the dim past. Identical editorials from Brown had appeared in 4 other East Coast papers. Westinghouse's first commercial AC system, based on Tesla's ideas, was set to be installed in only a few weeks' time in Buffalo. The department store Adam, Meldrum, and Anderson had already taken out advertisements touting the 498 AC-powered bulbs that were soon to shine from its Italianate ceilings. Unless, that is, Harold Brown succeeded in having such a system banned. It isn't true, said Westinghouse. AC is not more dangerous than DC, just the opposite. Why would the Evening Post print such a bald-faced falsehood? Do you know who owns the Evening Post? Said Paul. I do not. Henry Villard. Who is? Some middling newspaper tycoon, but a middling newspaper tycoon who happens to have quite recently come into possession of some 2,000 shares of stock in Edison General Electric. Westinghouse stopped his pacing. Edison gave him shares in exchange for denouncing me on his paper's front page? We'll never be able to prove it, said Paul. Can he do this? Can he really get the state legislature to ban my current? It depends. Damned lawyers, grumbled Westinghouse. Just give me a straight answer. Can he do this or can he not? I sent inquiries to Albany from the station. It appears that Edison has already gotten a friendly New York State senator to submit just such a bill. I'll hazard a guess that Edison has found a way to compensate his state senator as well. Having failed to produce a better product than you, he's now going to use the law to make your product illegal. I've already sent a message to my state senator. I'll argue your case before the legislature myself. He can't bribe all of them. Westinghouse lowered his gaze to the floor. AC is better, he said quietly. My work is better than his.
whoever he was talking to, it was not Paul. "Can you help me to understand it? I'm a layman. Talk to me like a layman. Your alternating current runs at twice the voltage of his direct current. You told me so yourself. Well, to a layman, twice the current, twice the danger, it sounds like common sense." When Westinghouse next spoke, his voice was low. "But this is the very thing about electricity. Nothing about it makes any common sense at all." Westinghouse summoned Reginald Fessenden for help with a demonstration. After only a few months here, Fessenden appeared to have aged a few years. He seemed exhausted. Whatever work he was doing and whatever stresses were being placed on him was quickly graying his temples. A smallish generator was attached to something Westinghouse called a capacitor. The thing was about 6 inches long, shaped like a cylinder, encased in a material, rubber, that was smooth and perfectly black. It looked, to Paul, something like a French dessert. At Westinghouse's request, Fessenden gave a few spins to a hand crank at the machine's side. It whirled with a soft hum. "And now," Westinghouse said, turning to Paul, "I'd like you to place each of your hands on one of those leads there. Yes, those are the ones." Paul looked at these leads, open-ended strips of cable, with trepidation. He remembered the flaming workman above Broadway. "Sir, won't that electrocute me?"
"Yes. When you put your hands on those leads, 110 volts of alternating current will shoot right through your body."
Paul blinked. This sounded like a certain death. Westinghouse registered Paul's fear.
"You don't trust me?"
"It's not that, but..." Paul looked at the machines. These deathly, futuristic things. Paul took a long, slow breath and grabbed as hard as he could at the wire leads. A popping sound. A sharp yell from deep within Paul's throat. And in under a second, it was over. Paul waved his hands in the air, wriggling his fingers to shake off the sting. The pain was akin to that of catching a baseball without a mitt. There'd been no flash of light, no spark, no caged lightning unleashed upon his flesh.
"Ow!"
said Paul finally when he remembered to speak.
"So," said Westinghouse patiently, "what have we learned?"
Paul turned to Fessenden for an answer. "Voltage," supplied Fessenden dutifully, "is not the same as power. AC may run at higher voltages than DC, but it does so with a variable amplitude. I can show you a notebook full of equations to explain this if you're curious."
"Aha!" said Westinghouse. "We're teaching Paul some science at long last. Now, what is it about the very nature of alternating current that makes it less dangerous?"
Paul again turned to Fessenden. "Right," said Fessenden. "So it's called alternating current, you'll remember, because it literally alternates direction hundreds of times per second, while direct current remains constant. Now, in response to electrical current, the muscles of the human body contract, as yours just did. This is why people are electrocuted to death. They grasp the current and they can't let go because the current contracts the very muscles that are holding on."
"The brain wants to let go," said Westinghouse, "but the muscles won't comply."
"Just now, as soon as you felt the shock, what happened?"
"I let go."
"You were able to let go. Because as the AC changes its direction each of those hundreds of times per second, there is actually an infinitesimal pause in the current. Think of it like a carriage. It goes in a circle clockwise as fast as it can. Then to turn around, it has to slow and then stop and then speed up again in the other direction. Such is the case with alternating current."
"Except for the slowing down part," corrected Fessenden.
Westinghouse agreed.
Electricity lends itself poorly to metaphor. Gravity, centripetal motion, much easier phenomena to explain by way of literary analogy. If Newton worked in poetry, we're left to toil in prose. I have pondered this on occasion.
Paul took in all that he'd been told. How could they explain all of this to potential customers without demanding that each of them try sticking their hands inside an AC generator to see for themselves? Having a better system than Edison's would do no good if they couldn't explain to the public why it was better. Reality mattered not at all. Perception was the whole of business. Edison had realized this before they had. While Westinghouse was using Tesla's discoveries to develop a superior product, Edison had skipped straight to developing a superior story. And stories were supposed to be Paul's expertise. As if he'd been reading Paul's train of thought, Westinghouse spoke again. The professorial tenor was gone from his voice.
"Paul," said Westinghouse quietly, "I rely on you to see this kind of thing coming."
Westinghouse's words were a cold breeze. They were so soft as to be almost inaudible, and yet they froze Paul in his place. "I'm sorry, Mr. Westinghouse," said Paul. "I knew that Edison was going to respond to our hiring of Tesla and our adoption of AC, but I didn't know how. I didn't think he'd go this far."
"This is your job," continued Westinghouse. "You are not, if this situation is to be any indication, doing it as well as I might hope."
Embarrassed, Paul looked to Fessenden. But the engineer was busying himself with the documents in his hands, conspicuously avoiding eye contact.
"You've made the mistake," said Westinghouse, "of underestimating the villainy of Thomas Edison."
"I have. And what I can promise you today is that I will never do so again." Paul was dismissed a few minutes later. He and Fessenden left the inventor to the quiet of his dark and empty laboratory.
"He'll get over it," said Fessenden as they walked side by side toward the mansion, across the moonlit lawns of the estate.
The muggy air threatened to burst into a summer storm above the country oaks.
"I've been on the receiving end of that same look. He has a way of making you feel 6 inches tall. But don't worry, he'll be on to someone else's failures tomorrow."
"How's Tesla doing?" Paul hadn't heard any complaints about Tesla in a few weeks, which he'd taken as a positive development. At the mention of Tesla's name, Fessenden grimaced.
"Well, I'm afraid that's going to be a bit difficult to explain."
Chapter 20. The difference of opinion between Mr. Tesla and Mr. Westinghouse. Only when they must choose between competing theories do scientists behave like philosophers. Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It turned out that Tesla had presented Westinghouse with a sketch. Something concerning the airless vacuum that filled the light bulbs. Westinghouse had suggested making a few tweaks and then testing both versions to see which operated better, and in response, Tesla had gone up to his office and shut the door in protest. 4 days later, Fessenden and his men had still not heard a word from Tesla. He had been scribbling nearly illegible demands for saltine crackers on the backs of machinery department requisition forms, and then slipping them without ceremony under his door. It had taken a full day for a passing char girl to notice them. The girl brought the papers to the attention of the butler, who then had to figure out some way of bringing the incident to Westinghouse's attention without causing the old man to break something glass-carved and expensive. At least they'd been able to fit the saltines under Tesla's door. Paul asked Fessenden to lead him to Tesla's apartment above the private laboratory. Tesla was apparently still locked inside, having reneged on his promise to come out once he'd been delivered his saltines. Tesla did not answer the door. Paul's pleas for a brief audience fell against the mute wooden doorway. As he turned down the hall, Paul saw a slip of white paper flit out from under Tesla's door. He bent over to pick it up. "Mr. Paul Cravath," were the first words he read on the machinery department requisition form. "It is imperative of me that I am quitting the employ of Mr. George Westinghouse. He is not of an inventing person. I take my leave and will see you in Manhattan, New York, New York. Nikola Tesla." The problems before Paul had just doubled. Not only would he have to manage the public war in print between Edison and Westinghouse, but he would now have to manage the private one between Westinghouse and Tesla. Unexpectedly, it was Tesla who selected the venue for the peace negotiations. Even though he seemed to have no taste for the food, nor the slightest interest in the wine, he appeared to have developed an affinity for Delmonico's. Not even Tesla was immune to the fragrance of exclusivity. He was merely immune to the expectations of politeness. So in the same week that Edison's lawyers trapped Paul into nuisance court appearances in three states over the differences between AC and DC, and the New York State Legislature held bloviating sessions about banning AC altogether, Paul had to beg his own client to travel to New York to share canard au olive with the man most likely to get them free of it all.
"This gentleman knows neither morsel nor iota of what it means to invent," sniped Tesla.
The Bordeaux that had been generously poured into his glass went unsipped.
"He has never so done, and never will he."
"This is the malarkey I've been dealing with for months," said Westinghouse.
"What I'd like to suggest," offered Paul impartially, "is that the language we all employ in this conversation take a more soothing tone." Tesla was having none of this.
"It is Mr. George Westinghouse whose language is sorely incapable of expressing the varied wonders in which I am conversant.
My point, precisely, does anyone have even the faintest idea of what he is talking about? He sounds like the only English he's ever learned is from Chaucer."
"I have not any such acquaintance," explained Tesla. "Is he another of your idiotic laboratory mammals?"
"Stop," pleaded Paul.
"Both of you, stop."
Paul had not thought this was going to be easy, but he had also not been aware of how personal their disagreement had become. "This is about more than the vacuum bulb issue, isn't it?"
"You are in the right," said Tesla. "The problem I have faced is that Mr. George Westinghouse is not an inventor."
"The problem I have faced is that Mr. Nikola Tesla is an ass."
"Mr. Tesla," said Paul, "Mr. Westinghouse is one of the most accomplished inventors in American history. This is not me speaking as his attorney, mind you, but as a man whose every day is graced by the products of his work."
"Air brakes," said Tesla. "You, sir, conjured a few bright notions of the halting of heavy objects traveling at speeds very fast. 20 years in the past, you made a quite big train stop. Bravo! The orchestra stands, and every patron shall bow."
"Please," said Paul, "we would all be helped by rather more clarity and rather fewer insults."
"What manner of electrical system have you invented, Mr. Westinghouse?"
Seeing Paul's look, Westinghouse answered with great patience.
"The alternating current system that my company is perfecting, and has already begun selling, is a product of both your recent breakthroughs, for which I give you full credit, and the Sawyer Mann patents, which we acquired some time ago. You, sir, had a good idea. I built a system that put it to use."
"Yes, indeed, precisely true," snapped Tesla. "But you have not invented a thing, do you see? Misters Sawyer and Mann, they are my peers. They had most brilliant ideas. You signed a check."
"They registered patents. I bought the rights to those patents, and then I combined their work with yours and my own,
and created, am in the process of refining an electrical system that will change the nature of human life. That's how business works.
The workings of your business, said Tesla, are not to be found listed in the catalogs of my concerns.
What are your concerns? Asked Paul, hoping this might provide some clarity as to the root of the men's disagreement.
Alternating current works. It can power motors, it can power lamps, it can power cities. I know this to be true.
And I as well, said Westinghouse. All right, said Paul. We find ourselves on common ground.
And so we should travel elsewhere, said Tesla. You wish for the building of an alternating current lamp, something different from that of Edison, but why? For your legal problems. Not for scientific discovery. You are wanting a new product. I am wanting a new invention.
At this, both Westinghouse and Paul were momentarily at a loss for words. The waiters took the opportunity to slip between the men fresh pours of Bordeaux and three sautéed duck breasts.
I make things, Tesla. I make wonderful things. My company manufactures triple-valve automatic air brakes and steam engines, and ampere meters and rotair valves. We make these things better than anyone else in the country, better than Eli Janney, better than George Pullman, most certainly better than Thomas Edison.
I will grant the factual veracity of that statement, offered Tesla.
In Edison, you two have a common foe, said Paul. But even Westinghouse ignored this.
What do you make? He asked Tesla.
Thoughts, answered Tesla, as if speaking to a child. I have thoughts, and my imaginings, they will last longer and drive deeper into the next centuries than shall your fragile toys.
The many things that I have built will last for ages.
No, Mr. George Westinghouse. Buildings are ephemeral. It is ideas that last forever.
Tesla stood and gestured to the server for his long coat. Paul mediated the wars of men who devoted their lives to creating things from thin air. But such different things? Westinghouse created objects. Tesla created ideas. While Edison, a few miles away, was busy creating an empire. Paul did not have a creative mind. He knew that men like Edison, Tesla, and Westinghouse possessed something he did not. An extra organ, an extra region of the brain, a God-lit candle such as the one that gave St. Augustine faith. There was a creative thing, and Paul knew he didn't have it. What would it feel like to be a creative man? To experience their eurekas, to thrill at their inventive madnesses? Paul tried to imagine what an Edison, a Tesla, a Westinghouse might feel in the moment of pure inspiration. But he couldn't do it. Paul did not invent. He solved. Problems came across his desk, and he solved them. Questions answered, mistakes corrected. The way Paul thought of it, if you asked him a question, he was exceptionally good at providing the right answer. But he wasn't the sort of person who came up with the questions. In the strangest sense, Paul felt that he saw these men more clearly than they would ever see one another, because he was not one of them. He could peer at them remotely. Three great giants in the misty distance. Three entirely incompatible ways of approaching science, industry, and business.
Farewell,
said Tesla, before turning away and walking out the door.
You may consider me no longer any part of your Westinghouse company.
Chapter 21. Intrigue at Carter, Hughes, and Cravath. Everything comes to him who hustles while he waits. Thomas Edison.
We're here to help,
lied Charles Hughes. He was leaning against the frame of Paul's office door in an attempt to appear casual. It wasn't working. Carter stood behind him. The elder partner's scowl disarmed the younger partner's imitation of friendliness.
"I appreciate that," lied Paul in return.
"I doubt it," said Carter. He made no effort to conceal his condescension toward his one-time protégé.
"Where are you with Tesla?" asked Hughes.
It was 2 weeks after Westinghouse and Tesla's ill-fated dinner. Paul had sent a few letters care of Lemuel Serrell, but had heard nothing back.
"I've received no response, but he's been seen in Manhattan a few times. Dining with high society, if you can believe it. My theory is that he's seeking financiers for his own company, setting up shop somewhere in New York, but Serrell either won't tell me exactly where he is or doesn't know himself."
Why were his partners so focused on Tesla? Of all the crises before them, the loss of Tesla seemed the most manageable.
"We must convince him to go back to Westinghouse," said Carter.
"Or find someone else to help Westinghouse create a non-infringing AC lamp." Paul knew that geniuses of Tesla's caliber did not grow on trees, but they had to grow somewhere. The loss of Tesla's expertise is a problem, to be sure, but it's a scientific one, not a legal one. The patents remain firmly in Mr. Westinghouse's hands.
"Yes," said Hughes. "That's what concerns us."
It seemed that Paul's partners knew something he did not.
"We looked over the contracts," said Carter.
$2.50 per horsepower on every unit sold?" asked Hughes.
"I don't have the papers in front of me, but yes, I believe that's the royalty Westinghouse is paying."
"And he's paying them whether or not Tesla is working with him to make the patents useful."
"Yes," said Paul. "Westinghouse keeps the patents, even if Tesla leaves. No change in conditions. This is a good thing."
"Well," said Hughes with a carefully feigned humility, "the thing of it is, it's not."
"How do you mean?"
"Oh my," said Carter. "He genuinely doesn't understand."
"Walter," said Hughes, "we don't need to make Mr. Cravath feel any worse about this, do we?"
"Make me feel worse about what?" asked Paul.
"When you negotiated with Mr. Serrell," said Hughes, "on your own, without our guidance, you negotiated a flat fee and a royalty structure that covered both Mr. Tesla's patents and his future work. And, of course, this structure was quite generous, wasn't it?"
"Well worth it, I believe," said Paul. "So does Westinghouse."
"Well worth it if it covered both the patents and their future refinement. But now that same fee only covers the patents. Mr. Westinghouse will have to bring on new men to replace Tesla, but he's still paying Tesla his full rate in perpetuity."
"You thought you were negotiating a patent deal, Paul," interrupted Hughes, "but you were actually negotiating a labor contract. And now your client, a client of this firm, is paying a usurious royalty rate for work that the other party is not obligated to perform."
"But..."
Paul tried to think of a response, his cheeks flaming with shame.
"How else could I have..."
"You could have put another goddamned clause into the deal," barked Carter. "If and when Tesla leaves, the royalty rate cuts to 50 cents, or 25 cents. Who knows what you could have gotten?"
"We employ such clauses frequently in these sorts of deals," said Hughes. "American Steel has them with Benjamin Mark. I've worked on similar deals with Serrell before. He was expecting the ask.
But you didn't think of it.
And you didn't consult us. He must be laughing himself silly."
How could Serrell have manipulated him so thoroughly? As Paul replayed the negotiation in his head, Serrell's wicked ingenuity at last revealed itself. Carter came to the same realization. "He offered you a position, didn't he?" Carter crossed his arms with the worn exasperation of looking at someone who might once have been so promising but had turned out to be so very, very dim. Hughes put the matter more sympathetically than his father-in-law. He offered you a position at his firm so that you wouldn't confer with us. He knew you were inexperienced, and he knew you were ambitious, eager to take all the credit yourself. So, by offering some simple conspiracy against us, he drove a wedge between you and your more experienced partners. Paul's shame curdled in his stomach. I did not know that such a clause was an option, he said with all the control he could muster.
You did not know, said Carter, because you are 27 years old. You are buried over your head in dirt, and you are too stupid to realize it's quicksand.
Walter, ventured Hughes, there's no need.
I do not require your false pity, said Paul with a force he hadn't intended. You're to play the angel on one shoulder while Mr. Carter is the devil on the other? Spare me the penny theater.
This is hundreds of thousands of dollars Westinghouse will lose because of your arrogance, said Carter. Millions, possibly.
The patents only last 6 more years, pleaded Paul lamely. It's a lot of money, to be sure, but in 6 years the damage will be done, and once we prevail over Edison, it won't matter.
Prevail? Said Carter. How in the hell is Westinghouse supposed to beat Edison when he's locked into paying a $250 per unit royalty that Edison is not? Westinghouse will either have to make his units more expensive than Edison's, which will be death in the marketplace, or sell them for a price such that he's barely making a profit, and then the whole corporation will sink. A fine position you've put him in.
It was the you that stung the most. This disaster was of Paul's making. I made a mistake.
You made a mistake, repeated Hughes. But you won't again.
That's all we ask.
Paul looked to Hughes for a rope of any kind with which to pull himself up.
What do you want? Asked Paul. But as soon as he said it, he realized what was coming. And he realized that he was powerless to fight it. They wanted to share the client. And if Paul refused, they would tell Westinghouse not only about the full implications of the expensive royalty he was obligated to pay, but that such payments might have been avoided had it not been for Paul's error. The bad news could be delivered in one of two ways, either with a tone of gentle inevitability, with which attorneys typically mollified their clients, or with the attachment of blame that Paul could not deny. The whole firm would likely be fired, yet only Paul was without additional clients. Only he could not recover from the loss of this one. Perhaps he had been too young for a case of this magnitude, Paul admitted to himself. Perhaps Westinghouse's faith in him had been misplaced. He accepted their proposal without argument.
Well then, said Carter, we'll send word to Westinghouse. We'll tell him it's firm policy, the size of this lawsuit being bigger and more important than any one man. 3 attorneys for the price of one. He can't be too upset. Paul watched as Carter and Hughes left the room. He did not turn away from the slight smiles on their faces. He wanted to remember their looks. If ever again he was tempted into overconfidence, he would have those smiles to chasten him. A beginning, a middle, an end, and then gone, to be recalled when necessary. A resolution firmed his spine as the door shut. There was, Paul knew, only one way to win, and that was to win Tesla back. He didn't leave that night until he'd figured out how. Chapter 22. A Visit to Number 4 Gramercy Park. No experiments are wasted. Thomas Edison.
Agnes and Fanny Huntington lived in a two-story brownstone at number 4 Gramercy Park. The block